Everything good in life is forged on the anvil of adversity. We want to start a movement of high achievers that have the courage to fashion a life of greatness. A movement of those brave enough to face the fires of self-improvement on the journey to peak expression. Smiths build things. Smiths get the job done. We are All Smiths. Welcome to the All Smith Project, where greatness is forged, not found. What is something you did as a child that you no longer do as an adult? For many, that answer is play. RX Smart Gear allows for your daily workouts to turn into play and exploration. In my training, the Frevo rope gives me access to a versatile rope that I can take with me wherever I go. On the road, at the beach, to the park, or playing at home, RX Smart Gear jump ropes fit my needs. We at AllSmith trust RX Smart Gear. Their gear is always reliable and gives me peace of mind that I will have top-notch equipment to support my health and fitness journey. Hop on over to RX Smart Gear and use the discount code AllSmith to shop their latest cutting-edge gear. Have your gear work with you and not against you. What's up, everybody? Welcome to another edition of the AllSmith Project. Today's guest is an artist and, most importantly, an incredible human. I'm very thankful to cross paths with him today. Adam Schmalholz, most importantly and most famously known as InQ. What's up, man?
I'm good, man. Almost nobody says my government name. It's so funny. Schmalholz.
That's why I went with it first, is I wanted to make sure that, like, we gave you the real intro. And I mean, I could very easily go down your bio. You've done so many cool things, but I know that'd make you shy away and kind of hide in the corner, and that the bio thing's not your favorite thing of them all.
That's for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Whenever somebody reads my bio before I go out on stage, I always get like slightly embarrassed, or there's a part of me that does want to hide. And I've kind of analyzed why that is. And I think the reason is that behind every accolade or success that they're reading off, I know the 100 hidden failures behind that success. And so I feel like it's kind of a lie to only say the things that I've accomplished, because the obstacles to getting there were just as much a part of the story.
A true truth seeker, man. And I've heard you talk about something related to that concept when you've discussed, like, hey, you know, as adults, we're all in pursuit of greatness. But when you're just focused on greatness, you lose your connection with play.
Yeah.
And play is something that's incredibly important to me. I'm sure people that listen to this podcast laugh about it, because one of my favorite lines is that we never really grow up. We just learn how to act in public. But what that really means is just, it's maintaining a childlike mindset to really believe that all things are possible and be okay with failure, have a healthy relationship with failure. When you hear those things associated with the pursuit of greatness, but you know the failures that it took to get there, what made you so comfortable with owning your truth and using truth as your vessel to then pursue creativity?
Well, you know, we were kind of discussing before things started about your father and his kind of health journey and your journey to support him through that. My father was not around at all. And my mom's a school teacher. I was born and raised in Santa Monica. And I think that when you don't have one of the parents in the household, it tends to make you very self-reflective early, because you start thinking about belonging. And, you know, as a young boy, I would always kind of think, what is a man supposed to be like? And so it made me really question myself and start to, like, observe my life early. And it's only later, when I got into spoken word and poetry, that I started funneling all of those questions and observations about myself and my environment into my work. So I think truth was always the foundation of what I was seeking, because I didn't feel comfortable or safe completely to be myself and to have that be okay. But then again, that's part of what put me on the journey. And I'm so grateful for who I am and where I am talking to you right now. So I'm appreciative for all.
I definitely honor all of that. And the thing that really stands out to me is that when you think about a man, in my opinion, there needs to be this unique blend between the masculine and the feminine. There definitely needs to be a stoic side that's like primal and getting the job done and protective and providing. And there needs to be a very strong presence there. But then simultaneously, there does need to be emotional intelligence, and there needs to be empathy and compassion and emotion that's understood. And I think it's the unique harmony between those these two categories that really makes the ultimate man. And what's fascinating is you growing up without that example, in my opinion, I've met some pretty awesome people and talked to some very, very successful men on this podcast. And I don't know, you epitomize someone to me that is really exemplifying the ideal man. And so it's cool to me that even though you didn't know exactly what it looked like growing up, you found your way there, which is pretty rad.
Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you saying that. Yeah, I mean, look, I'm very sensitive. You know, my mom was my example, and we have a complex relationship, but I'm just unbelievably grateful for all of her sacrifice in raising me and teaching me good morals and integrity. And I think that sensitivity was a part of what she taught me, and that emotional, I don't know, empathy or whatever. I can feel into other people. Like if I walk into a room, I tend to be able to feel everybody out, as well as like analyze the situation. I can feel the situation. And I think that my intuition was a muscle that I grew early on because of my mom being my primary relationship and how she was in the world. And also because, as I said before, I didn't really feel safe, you know, in a lot of different ways, mentally, emotionally, probably physically, even spiritually, you know. So I think that was like one of the pillars of my life. But then a lot of the other manhood stuff I had to teach myself. And I learned a lot of that stuff through television, actually. So a lot of the stuff that I learned, actually, I had to unlearn later. But, you know, once again, we're all like these really complicated tapestries. You know, like our personalities are like these crazy quilts that are so unique to us. And I love who I am in the world. And I think I use that sensitivity and the manhood that I grew into in my work, because what I try to do is provide space for people to listen to my poetry and connect to the deeper mirror of humanity, and also to create their own poetry, so that they can have an experience of being vulnerable from a place of strength.
Yeah, man, I've become a huge fan of your work. And one of the things that I was wondering about as I was driving over here to connect with you today was not only just the curiosity around the sensitivity that you possess and what I can hear in your voice, but the pain that maybe you experienced growing up, maybe feeling subtly misunderstood or feeling isolated or alone and not having that companionship, because you really do understand how to piece together words that create a subtle vibration that maybe truly penetrate the porous skin of most individuals, and then maybe leverage that crack in the door to get inside their brain and deeply connect with them where they don't feel lonely anymore. They can better understand some of the concepts that you're talking about that are very relatable. One of which that I'd love to explore first with you, I wrote it down here, and it's around this concept of a universal truth. The universe doesn't need to respond to a lie, no matter how hard you try. The truth will not be denied. It doesn't judge, and it doesn't choose sides. It just attaches to the frequency and matches the vibe. I try to pull in your voice there a little bit and kind of connect with you. I know I've heard you say in other podcasts you like when other people read in.
I do, when I say
that out loud, man, how'd that make you feel?
I felt great. I mean, it was cool to hear it in your authentic voice and to maybe even watch you thinking about the concepts as you were reading it. You know, I tend not to lead my audience too much from the standpoint of like, sometimes after shows, people will be like, oh man, when you said that one thing, you know, it really, really moved me or it shifted me. And then they'll say that thing back to me and it's not the thing that I said. It's like actually the wrong thing, but I never correct them because to me, it's less about my poetry and it's about whatever it is that they need to receive. So I'm not even too precious on my own words once they leave my mouth or my own like intention behind those words. Like, who am I to tell somebody else how to perceive a piece of art? And that's what makes art so interesting, is that everybody can perceive it differently. I was in a movie the other day and it was Napoleon, and I fucking loved the movie. Have you seen it yet?
I haven't seen it. Okay. I'll definitely have to check it out in the next couple weeks.
I think you're really going to like it, Bryce. The thing is, I could understand why somebody wouldn't like it. You know, the Ridley Scott was the director, and so I would assume that a lot of people that go see it are expecting like Gladiator 2 or something like that. And it's not that. It's a really complex movie about a narcissistic war figure in history, you know, centered obviously around France, but all of Europe at the time, and his, you know, unhealthy but codependently connected relationship to his wife. And it's just like a, you know, a long, slow, drawn out, interesting movie. And I thought the acting was impeccable. This fucking guy gets up halfway through and he's like, this movie sucks. And then he just walks out, you know? And I looked at my wife and I was like, are you liking this? And she was like, yeah. And I thought, that's what makes art so beautiful, you know, is that I'm sitting here like really into a movie. And even though I understand why somebody might not like the movie, I really like the movie. And not only did this guy not like the movie, it wasn't worth his time, you know? So I don't even know why I went there, but I guess art is all subjective. And I love.
No, totally. And I think you articulated really well. And I've heard you say it before, and that is, I might bastardize this a little bit, but I think it's something along the lines that the art is more important than the artist.
Yeah,
and I think that's such a humble way of looking at it, because what I say and what you hear are two different things. You might be in a state where certain words that I say might be triggering, they might be loving, they might be inspiring, and they might completely throw you off the rails.
Yeah.
I think, though, what the magic component is that there is something to the human experience that doesn't quite meet the eye, but it's felt. And I think certain words set at a certain frequency or certain creations in the artist world can allow people to feel a certain way. And you epitomize that. You're a walking analogy of the Maya Angelou quote, which is, nobody cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And your ability to walk into a room, understand the frequency and like who's in the room, and then match that frequency and how you deliver on certain words is just so cool to me. And I'm very certain too that in that component of observing the Napoleon movie, for you, you're observing the art. You're not just there for like certain expectations that you may have around the story ideation of Napoleon or what you think it should be. You're there to explore and be like, hey, how do they piece together this story? How do these artists then, you know, connect with actors to then help them generate a vibe? And then, and when you look at it with a creator's eye and with an explorative eye, it's different than when you go in there with a certain set of expectations.
Yeah, that's such a great point, man. Well, let me ask you, what did that poem mean to you, the one that you read? And then I can tell you what it meant to me.
I'll summarize it. There's three things that you can't really hide: the sun, the moon, and the truth. And I think in a world of wearing certain masks in pursuit of trying to get the thing, whatever the thing is for the individual, eventually, whether it's through hard things, through a relationship, through business, whatever the thing is, I humbly believe that that mask is going to come down. And you're going to see the true authenticity of the individual. And I truly believe that that's a universal truth. There's preconceived notions. There's all kinds of labels that get placed on people. But time eventually reveals a little bit of the soul. So that's kind of what I feel and think about when I read the universal truth piece from you.
Yeah, that's beautiful, man. Really, really well said. That's very deep. I think, you know, for me, it's similar, which is just basically like the internal world helps to create the external world. Not completely, but it definitely helps to shape reality from the standpoint of what it is that we choose to focus on. And so we can be presenting one thing, like you said, the mask, you know, and we can navigate reality that way. But eventually the world will respond to the internal frequency. And it will be attracted to whatever it is that we're putting out. And so I think that
that's definitely kind of, honor that.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was getting at. I think that the personal truth changes all the time. I mean, there's things that were true to me at moments in my life that aren't true anymore because I've grown. But I always think in art and otherwise, if you start with your momentary personal truth, you will connect to a universal truth. And that's what I try to do when I write.
Yeah, man. That's special. That's cool. Kind of relates to the golden rule, right? Treat others the way you want to be treated.
Yeah.
Not sure why that came to mind, but I feel like that is a little bit of a universal truth that seems to float around the surface a little bit.
Yeah.
Where does your creativity come from, man? I know your name was given to you by a friend that thought about, like, in question, was like, hey, man, you're very inquisitive. And that's kind of how you got the name InQ. But where did the curiosity come from? And what does your nickname mean to you?
I mean, I've had it forever. I'm 45 now, you know. And my buddy gave me that nickname Inquiry when I was 15. And people just started calling me InQ after that. And then people started calling me Q. And it's so much a part of who I am now that, like, it is, I promise you, when I hear it, it sounds as real or fake as Adam Schmalholtz does. You know, it just all sounds made up to me. But I do think that it...
Even through the screen, man, when I introduced you as Adam, I could feel you like, whoa, this guy like looked me up, but also that sounds weird.
Right. Well, it does kind of sound weird. Nobody ever says, ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Adam Schmalholtz. But the thing is, Schmalholtz to me is a real part of my personality as well. Like, it just sounds like, I don't know how I can be sometimes, which is like, I'm pretty much like a micro pessimist and a macro optimist. Like, I can zoom out and I really like can think we're moving in the direction of infinite possibility and hope, even when times are hard. But on my daily, you know, when I move around, sometimes I like to get annoyed at things, almost like Larry David or something like that. So that's like my Schmalholtz side. And InQ is more of the person that can kind of like zoom out. Instead of looking at the pixels, I can see the full picture. And hopefully...
See, so basically you're admitting on our podcast that you've got dual personality disorder.
Well, I'm a Gemini, bro. You know? So Geminis have a bunch of different voices in their heads and they have to learn how to navigate all of them. We're like sitting at a long table, you know, and we discuss things before we move out into the world. But hopefully when we do, we move out in an authentic, unified way, right?
Well, I mean, those are great options. So when you enter into a room and you've got a fuck ton of frequencies that you're trying to match, inevitably you can be like, hey man, you point to him. It's like, you're up. Your personality is going to match this room today. And so you have the ability to have tools in the toolbox to know which version of you is going to best serve your audience in that moment.
Yeah, that is so well said, man. Thank you for acknowledging that. It's rare that somebody reflects that back to me. I do have an ability to be myself in a lot of different ways and connect to a lot of different people. And I think that's probably because of how I grew up. I mean, we're from opposite sides of the same place, but we're from the same place. And when you grow up in a really diverse environment, you feel very comfortable connecting to lots of different people in lots of different ways.
Oh yeah.
And I mean diverse in every possible way you can think of diverse. Diversity of, you know, race and economic stuff and religion and diversity of thought and diversity of just political, everything you can imagine, I kind of grew up with. And because of that, I know how to be myself in all sorts of environments and feel comfortable. And I think that helps me in life, but I also think it helps me as an artist because I want to be able to connect to as many people as possible truthfully, so that they can hopefully open up to moving into a deeper place in their mind or a deeper place in their heart through my work.
Yeah, man. I love that you said that. Just to give people context, we're both from Los Angeles, you being from Santa Monica, me being from the San Fernando Valley, and just a quick trip, you know, over the beautiful 405 and sneaking over from the beautiful 101. But you summarized that really well. The diversity in Los Angeles is huge. But there's a few commonalities that I experience, and I totally respect if you disagree here, but the three big ones for me were around love, sport, and art, and specifically hip hop, to be honest. I mean, me being from the basketball world, it's like my buddies in the locker room, like it didn't matter if I was a white boy trying to take a ball and put it in a hoop. Like I was vibing with the boys in the locker room, man. And this other concept of just, hey, we're trying to win. We're trying to become the best versions of ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's a really special component that always brought us together. Then this component of love, you know, one of us going through an injury or losing a family member, like, hey, bro, no matter what, I got your back. Mm-hmm. And those three components always united us in the midst where it brought this unique presence where everything outside of that started to fade and dissipate. And it was like a brotherhood that came together. Didn't matter socioeconomic background, didn't matter where you were from, what your name was. It was just like, hey, we're here. And we're doing this thing together and we're growing up together and trying to figure out life, girls, school, sports, past, present, future. And there is a connection that comes from that. And I don't know the specificity of the words that you used, but you've talked about that before. I've listened to some talks and poems that you've shared around. It feels so diverse with the keyboard warriors and everybody trying to one-up everybody on social media and in the internet space. But then we get out into the real world and it's like, we need to come together.
Yeah, I mean, I do my very best, man. And I do hear and agree with everything that you just said. I mean, that was my experience too. I mean, I wasn't as athletic as you are and were growing up, so.
I don't know, man. I was just hanging on by a thread trying to do the next right thing.
Well, I never grew, bro. I was like super into basketball too, you know, and thought I was going to be whatever I thought I was going to be. And then, you know, pretty much didn't make it past the all-star at the boys club team, you know? But I loved it still, you know, I loved it. And then I also loved hip hop and it still had the same thing. I mean, you know, it was about brotherhood. It was about competition. It was about having each other's backs. And I mean, I wouldn't trade how I grew up for anything. I think it's like the most beautiful thing. The most I've ever learned in my life is from people that were different from me. And, you know, for other people that have never had that experience, I wish that they could. And now I get to take that out into the world. And like, I mostly try to treat everybody with as much kindness and compassion as I can. And my experience is mostly people treat me the same way. So I think you get what you give often.
Yeah, that's a very good way to say it, man. The Trident family taught me something really important this last year, that we are all a bundle of stories, both good, bad, and everything in between. All of their cold brews remind their customers that they are part of something bigger than themselves. I start my day with the sweet cream cold brew as I am prepping my mind and body for fitness, service, coaching, and podcasting. With various locations in San Diego, they offer over 14 nitro cold brews and a variety of specialty drinks. You can find the perfect brew and pair it with one of their treats from the Keto Bakery. You can check them out over at tridentcoffee.com and use code ALLSMITH to take your coffee experience to the next level.
Your relationship and the way you describe love is special. I've heard it a few times, but I want to say it here firsthand. Love isn't just something you feel, it's something you do. When I say that, what kind of comes to mind? And let's unpack that a little bit together.
Yeah, I mean, love is a, you know, it's a feeling, of course, but it's also an action. You know, it's something, it's making somebody's life a little bit better. It's complimenting them. It's doing them a favor. It's seeing them and also being seen and being willing to have real love means you are willing to risk it all because it's worth it to show up as your authentic self over and over and over again and keep trying when it doesn't feel good so that once again, it can feel effortless. I think a lot of people think that love is a destination and that once they arrive there, it's over. But love is really a beginning. When you fall in love, it is an endless path of self-discovery, self-exploration, and connection. I think that when people think it's a destination, they almost like take it for granted. Or stop trying once they arrive, or expect it to always be easy. It's like love isn't supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard because the things that are hard are the things that are most worth it. And there is nothing more worth it in my life than my love.
For sure, man. On the other side of some blood, sweat, tears, and consistent effort is typically everything that we ever desired.
Yeah.
And I'll share this with you. It almost makes me a little emotional because I say it often, but I don't know that I've felt it and resonated with it as much as I do right now. I think in the final three sentences of my father being alive, he held my hand and he looked me in the eyes and he couldn't speak loudly, but he whispered, "Always be dating." And that was such a profound thing that I'm not sure I actually totally understood it until now. You defining that as love isn't something you feel, it's something you do. Always be dating really means like you're always loving that person. You're always nurturing the relationship. You're always putting in the effort as if it was your first date.
Yeah.
You're holding the door open. You're trying to be gentlemanly. You're walking on the street side. You're trying to really genuinely, as your name inspires, be inquisitive, be genuinely interested and not just make the relationship transactional or stagnant, which then allows the fireworks and the magic to kind of die. And I think your definition of that, this is like the first time in real time, I'm like, whoa, I wonder if it meant that to him. Maybe it did, maybe it didn't, right? Like you talked about the words and how they resonate with people versus how they don't. I'm like, whoa. That's some powerful shit right there.
I mean, maybe it matters, but maybe it doesn't matter, right? Maybe the fact that he
totally
said that to you, it was wise conceptually and energetically, no matter what he intended it to mean, because of how you receive it at this moment. I mean, I'm not going to like front, like it's not like my wife and I have like a perfect relationship. We argue, we fight, but we fight to be in real time with each other. We fight for the connection, for the commonality, for the truth, you know, so that we never build like resentment because We're always like present with each other. And there's nothing more important in my life. You know, I assume that when we have kids, it would be a deeper love beyond my imagination. But I think that having a primary relationship can anchor you to the world. And like,
yeah, that's very beautiful.
To use your father's words, to always be dating, to always be trying to discover who it is that you're with, is a really like noble approach, because like we're always discovering who we are. You know, we're not we're not like these calcified creatures. We're not totally stagnant. We're always growing, always changing, always learning, always expanding. And our partners are too. So it's like we have to continue to let them get to know us and get to know them. And hopefully we can grow on this journey together.
Yeah, man, that's very well said. This is going to be hard for me. I've been nervous to do this, but I've got to do it. One of my favorite poems that you've ever wrote is 85.
Yeah.
And it very much relates to this concept of love. I'm going to give my stab at it. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read
Do you want me to read
most
it?
Of it. Yeah, let's do that.
Would you
let's
prefer if I read it? If you want to
How
read
about
it,
I start?
I would love
I'll,
to hear
I'll start
it.
And then you take over. We'll
okay,
do it together.
That sounds good. We'll do a collab.
I love that. You ready?
Yeah, you look at me when you're ready, you pass it off whenever you feel.
Okay. I want to fall in love at 85. Go on shuffleboard dates and dance to hip hop from 95. Our song would be Staying Alive, but only for the message. Otherwise, we'd keep away from disco. It's depressing. We'd rock matching tracksuits and rope gold chains. We'd look like Run DMC, but in their old age. We'd take aerobics class and wear bifocal glasses and eat at IHOP and hold hands at Sunday masses. And when it comes to the bedroom, well, nothing much would happen in the bedroom because we're 85. But we would still be down to take a walk or to take a drive or sit and talk and have a drink and watch the passersby and ask each other why and how and who and where and when. And then we'd laugh and cry again about the people we had been.
And I would touch your withered skin and comment on how thin it is to keep in something infinite. And she would smile sweet and blush, then tell me that I think too much. She's right, I think too much. It's always been a problem. But then again, that's how I made my green like the goblin. When I was in my 20s, I was eating top ramen, counting up my pennies, saving up to go food shopping. But now I'm 85, and somehow I feel more alive. I turn my hearing aid up and bump Jurassic 5. I read the sports page while she peruses classifieds. We like antique stores, garage sales, and barter buys. And when it comes to the bedroom, well, hopefully, every once in a while, she lets me knock her boots into the floral patterns of our bedpost, then hold her head close like death isn't chasing us, planning on erasing us and replacing us with better versions of us, reshaping us, remaking us, then recreating us with new identities so we can make new memories. Hush, little baby, learn to walk and talk and think and lie and feel and fight and love and die and never get the answers why. She dips a joint of grass and wheatgrass and we get high. Her hair is silver as the moon in the San Diego sky. We still pop pills, but it's not the Xanax anymore. Whenever we can't sleep, we listen to the ocean floor. She got a sound of the CCD for me from the Brookstone store. And ever since, I've been snoring like a really good metaphor for snoring. Sorry, I go blank sometimes. What? I'm 85. I'm not complaining. I'm just happy that I'm still alive and happy that I have my better half by my side, Superfly. She doesn't look a day over 75. Woo. When I first saw her, I was totally in awe. She was classical, so I was like, yo, yo, ma. And that was all it took. A single look and I was shook. I fell for her like some loose shingles from our Spanish roof, and I'm a lover till she loses every last root and has to glue dentures to her gums to chew solid food. Ooh, now that's real love, dude. That's some push comes to shove love. Not when it's convenient love. Hospital bed love. Feed her ice chips love. Never leave the room, love. Sleeping in the chair, love. Pray to up above, love. Have to pull the plug. Miss her in my bones, love. Everything about her, love. Die within a month, love. Can't live without her love. Love. The only reason that we are alive, and none of us should have to wait until we're 85. That was a collaboration, wow, bro. Man. I love that.
That was really cool. That got me fired up, man. That your ability to elongate certain vowels and consonants, add in such appropriate pauses, and then also have some of the subtleties that just, they add the nice rhythm, they convey the point to really allow you to feel it in between your ears, in your soul, in your heart. And you definitely have a gift, man, and it's cool to be a part of that and share that with our audience today. That was really special. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for reading it, and thanks for all the kind words. You know, like, when I was kind of like younger, I've been doing this so long. I mean, literally since I was 14 or 15. So it's like the longest relationship of my life, writing and performing. And my relationship with writing and performing has changed so much over the many seasons, all the people that I've been throughout my life. But one thing that has always been solid is I always try to create from a place of immediate truth. And one thing that I learned along the way is that I was trying to use big words to express these big truths, and they were actually just getting in the way of the communication of what the poem wanted to say. So I stopped doing that. I stopped trying to sound smart or deep or philosophical, and I just started trying to express whatever the simplest version of what I wanted to say was. And and so I love playing with these poems, and you know, they sound different even over time.
That's rad, man. I mean, simplicity really is the ultimate sophistication, and being able to communicate to, you know, somewhere between that like third and fifth grade level, I think resonates with most people. What is it about the rhyming, right? Like, sometimes you're able to make it rhyme, sometimes not, but you find a way to make it work no matter what. Is that something that was very calculated early on? Did that come about later on in the developments of your craft? Or what is that? What role does the rhyming play?
I mean, I started out rapping, and I was very serious about that. It's like weird for a 45-year-old man to say that, but at the time, you know, that was what I thought I was going to do forever. And when I was 19, I wound up in an open mic for poets in LA called the Poetry Lounge, which still exists. And it's one of the biggest open mics in the country. And I started doing my rapping a cappella, and people responded. And so I think that the rhyming was always the foundation of any way that I was trying to communicate art into the world. And it's so second nature to me now. It helps my memorization. It also gives me almost like railroad tracks, even though I don't know where the train is going exactly. I just kind of like do them one at a time, and it tells me where it wants to go. So oftentimes I'm surprised, in the end. Like when I wrote that piece, I didn't know that it was going to end that way. It wasn't something that I had intended from the beginning. And as I was writing it, I got emotional in the end because I was surprised. And I think there's something kind of beautiful about that self-discovery in real time, because hopefully it allows the audience to be surprised as well, rather than it being overly strategic or having an agenda from the beginning.
Yeah, that better helps me understand your creative flow a little bit and understand how you're able to find your way. Like even when I podcast, like I don't sit with like 15 questions. I got to ask these to the guest. It's kind of like flowing with the conversation and seeing and maybe having a few bullet points, but being able to access those based on the intuition. And I like that the rhyming component is a key part there. What does your creative flow look like? Like, how do you get yourself into the state to be able to access that level of flow? Is it working out? Is it certain ambiance type music or a place that you go to begin your writing craft? And then how do you funnel that towards the memorization and the ability to articulate at a frequency that's then going to be delivered on a big stage?
It's a good question. I have not like one set routine, you know, I kind of like when I was putting in maybe my 10,000 hours, I was really obsessed and I wrote all of the time, you know, and shared all of the time. But now I kind of only write when I have either an assignment that I'm inspired by, whether it's a collaboration with a brand or a subject that I really want to explore, or if I just have something that I want to say. You know, I try to pay attention to when I'm inspired or when I'm moved or when I'm pissed off. And if something stands out in reality, I can kind of like, you know, take it and put it into my phone. And then I can go back to it at any point because it's already started in the truth. And so the rest of the piece will almost write itself if I give it enough time and space, because it started in a place that was already real. Rather than me going like, what do I think the audience wants to hear?
Oh, very well said.
Yeah, because I think that would get me in a place of like, I would start to want to be validated or valued while I was creating the piece, rather than just having a conversation with me and my higher self, which is mostly
what I think I'm trying. It takes a level of maturity to get to that though, right? Like in the beginning, you know, in order to get the recognition to pursue what you really want to pursue, you kind of have to do that in the onset. And then over the course of reps and time and energy, you're like, whoa, I don't actually want to be owned by somebody else's headspace or seek the validation of other people. I actually want to do this because it's what I want to do. This is what lights my heart on fire. Now I'm going to be able to share this intrinsic motivating art with the world in a way that I think is going to be more unique and full of all of the wonder and curiosity that I possess about these unique subjects, as opposed to, hey, I'm trying to do this so I can be liked or validated, which maybe that works for a small amount of time, but that doesn't work long-term. And in my opinion, really leads to burnout probably.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it could be applied to any area of your life. I mean, look, I think that it's one of those things, what gets you here won't get you there. You know, there are things that can get you to a place of success in life. But if you maintain that space of, I don't know, that space or that fuel for your engine to try to go somewhere else, you're never going to get anywhere else. And you will burn out in some form or fashion. But like, I think if some of the best things in life actually don't come from the friction of trying to prove something to someone else. It's really trying to prove something to yourself, or just following your own enthusiasm or your own curiosity or your own bliss or even your own obsession. You know, obsession has pain in it, but it turns pain into purpose. It's the process of alchemy. Art is the process of alchemy. You know, probably you would say what you do with CrossFit or creating the space for other people to channel that energy into something beautiful, to build something up in their lives, self-confidence, health, mental, emotional, physical, spiritual health, and then to echo that out into their lives, in their smaller circles and in their community, and even in their work. You know, I think, yeah, I'm excited to continue to use that fuel at this stage in my life, because I don't know exactly where I want to go next, but I know if I keep checking in with myself and I know where I am now, wherever I go next will be a ripple from where I am now, which is, you know, the truth.
I love those lenses, because sometimes we're in pursuit of like trying to follow the path that's already been laid. But for someone like you, it's very much like, don't go where the path may lead, go instead where there is no path and leave a trail. And what's unique about that is like, you're operating with a machete, and some people might be chaotic and robust and really aggressive with that. And then some people might like tinker periodically and be like, hey, I'm curious, where is this going to take me?
Right.
But this intrinsic confidence of knowing that wherever you end up, you're going to figure it out, you're going to be okay. That's fucking cool to me, man, because so many people are afraid of the uncertainty. Hey, what's on the other side of that ridge? I've never seen that before. I don't really know. But that intuition and knowing, hey, when I get there, it's a new experience. I'm experiencing life. I'm living life. I'm very curious what's over there. And when I get there, I'm going to make new friends. I'm going to see new things. And I know I'm going to be able to figure out, because I have a proven track record that I've figured it out time and time again.
Yeah, and to your great point, I mean, even if you are afraid, which I get afraid of shit all the time, so what? You know, it's just not being afraid of your fears. It's acknowledging them, accepting them, and then doing it anyway. And knowing that, you know, even if you fail, you're going to learn probably more than if you had succeeded. And in failure, you have so many new tools to use in your life. So it's giving yourself the freedom to fail so that you can have the freedom to succeed. And giving yourself the freedom to play outside of your comfort zone, so that when you get back into your comfort zone, you're stronger and you have more ways to adapt to whatever it is that you want to put your time and your energy and your love into.
That really is a cool way to think about it, man. I want to jump back into your experience at the Poetry Lounge and just the community of people that you met. I've heard you say it before that was one of the really strong pivotal pillars that motivated you early on to then want to pursue a career in this, and just a tribe of people that you guys were able to kind of ping pong ideas, metaphors, analogies, and then allow those things to go from a feeling and then an idea to reality. What was your time like there? And do you think you'll ever go spend some more time at that place and with those people?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely still spend time with those people, because we have a community that exists beyond the space, but the space also exists. And I have such a reverence for it. I mean, it really was a church without religion for me. It was an artistic college. I never went to college for more than 1 year. I went to San Fran State, and then came back and was at SMC, and I fucking got in a fist fight on camp. I hated school. I always hated school. I was never a good student. I never thought I was capable or smart. So I kind of fucked off or just tried to be invisible, basically. And after that, I was like, all right, I'm going to pursue art full time. And I mean, that was much longer struggling than I ever could have imagined. I mean, I didn't make any money until I was like past 30. And yet during that time, I just kept showing up at this open mic, and, you know, those people became a family for me. and they sharpened all of my skills. Some of the best artistic experiences I've ever had is watching other poets on stage. We had some of the most talented people in the world. And I was so lucky to come up in that environment because I had a lot of big brothers and big sisters, and I had a lot of little brothers and little sisters. And it's an each one teach one thing. And there's nothing that can really divide us as a group. I mean, you know, as lives move on, responsibilities change, time changes, you don't get to hang as much, you don't talk as much, but we all have each other's back still to this day.
That's badass. It's cool that you have that tribal nature. And something that stands out to me just from a primal standpoint, you talked about the young bucks and then the older gurus that you were probably chasing after. That's such a great place to be because you don't want the young guys to catch you. And right. You also are chasing the guys that have been around the block a few times more than you, and you're trying to get those reps to catch their level of success. And that's the sweet spot of success. When you're at the top, it's a little bit harder because you can develop that level of complacency. You might be making a few bucks. You might have a little notoriety. You might have lost that chip a little bit on your shoulder. And it sounds like you positioned yourself not just in a place where everybody had each other's back, but there was this little bit of competitive edge that when 100%. You guys stepped up to the mic, it's like, hey, I'm about to blow this out of the water.
We all had that. And it was very competitive, like sports. I mean, we all supported each other, but we definitely all wanted to one-up each other as we supported each other. And, you know, both of those things existed at the same time. It's like you and your teammates or whatever, you know, of course you're going to go out, you're going to try to beat the other team. You guys have each other's backs. You're going to war athletically, but you also want to be the best you can, you know, within the group. You want to provide the most value. You want to challenge yourself. You want to challenge each other. The friction makes the fire. So
it's a great line. I crossed paths about a week ago with a really good high school friend that I haven't seen in like 8 or 10 years, man. He's 6'4", long wingspan, talented as hell. And I remember when I got to Taft High School, he and I were like competing to be the guy our freshman year. This was just the JV team before either of us ever made varsity. And it was funny because like we had each other's back around this commonality of like wanting to win, wanting to like fit into a new school and all the things. But then there was like, we both had these monstrous egos. So like after practice, it was like gym was closed up. We go to the back where there was just like a whole slew of basketball hoops with chain nets. Mm. And we're just playing one-on-one over and over again. Bloody knees, like you lay it up or try to dunk, your fingers getting stuck in the chain net, your fingers are bleeding. We're talking all kinds of smack to each other. But now he's one of my best friends, dude.
That's so cool.
And we don't even talk basketball anymore. We just look back to some of those days, and it's just the epitome of what you said. Like when you go through struggles and there's this strong level of respect, it's like now I see him and the hug's a little bit longer. The conversations are a little bit deeper. There's always conversation around, hey, how's your well-being? How's your health? You doing good? Like, what's your family like? And those are the deep, meaningful relationships, man, that we take to our grave.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always the thing. You might not even remember half the performances you gave, but you remember those relationships and those battles.
That's so true. Yeah, I love that. I love that image too of you guys kind of going at it with the metal hoops. You know, the metal.
The metal nets. Hoop of like him actually dunking and me just like trying to lay it up and like pull on the rim and make it look like I dunked and then like bleeding my hands for no reason, but to validate my ego. Good times.
I love basketball so much, man. You know, it just must have been cool to keep playing at such a high level like that. That's something I really admire and respect.
You know, it's interesting when I unpack basketball and I look back, and I say this often, but it's a mystery looking forward and it's science looking back. And it's like when you're young, you're like the guy, you're trying to do everything, and you move up and maybe you're the guy for a little bit longer, but it's like you start looking at it through a different set of lenses and you're like, all right, what can I really do better than other people? And what kind of things do I really struggle at? And it's like striving to elevate some of your weaknesses while simultaneously being like, hey, I'm not giving up these strengths. And it's this constant push and pull battle to think, how do I fit? Okay, if I can, you know, take more charges or play better help side or communicate better or wave my towel and be energy on the bench, like whatever the role is, in the words of Elon Musk, man, I just wanted to be useful. And so I think that's what allowed me to kind of hang on a little bit longer than most, was that I didn't hold on to the ego of like, hey, this is my role. I'm supposed to be the guy at every level that I play. It's like there's 450 jobs in the NBA. Unfortunately, I never made it to that level. A lot of my really good friends did, and I love those guys. But if you're going to continue to play this game, when you look back at every single role player in the NBA, man, these guys average 30 or 40 points a game in high school.
Right.
They went to certain colleges where they had certain roles that then allowed them to then elevate into that next level. But man, every day, man, somebody wants your job.
Right.
And you probably experienced that a little bit in your world, but it's just a fun way to think about it now in retrospect and kind of being a little bit distanced from it. But at the time, it was a cool experience just to think, okay, like these other guys probably are better than me, but they're not willing to surrender to that role. And that role is what's needed on the team right now. And that's what's going to get me on the court. Cool. I'm going to do that thing.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about sports that I so deeply admire and respect is that the structure doesn't allow for victimhood in any way, shape, or form. And that's so awesome when you're taught that as a young person, when you're taught to not make excuses and to show up for each other and to sacrifice, and that hard work leads to results, and that when things don't work out, get back up and go even harder, you know, to not feel sorry for yourself, to acknowledge your losses, but to know that you can rise again and win another day, that you can get better. And I think that, you know, there's certainly the shadow side of sports as well, but I'm not going to talk about that right now. I'm just going to talk about those things. I think those things, you know, when those things show up in your life outside, it's so beneficial, because if you apply that thing to any other area, it is just such a strategy for success. And it's not something that I personally was taught. It's something that I had to kind of teach myself over a long period of time. And so, that's something that I look at when I think of like people who have sacrificed to be the best in sports, or just to be role players, but to do the absolute best they could in those roles. I know what it took to get there, both physically and mentally.
Yeah, that's very true. It's just cool looking back at the pool of talent in the Los Angeles area all over. And like, even the guys that don't make it, or, you know, eventually fall off, or something happens in their life circumstance where, you know, maybe they didn't end up on what society would define as success.
Yeah.
Man, when I look back, there was just so much talent. I mean, guys that were rapping in the locker room, guys that were really good with fashion and style, other guys that were really good at just creating community and vibing, other people that were the class clowns, that were comedians way before comedians were cool.
Right.
And then, you know, obviously you had the students and the rule followers, and everybody kind of fell into a category. But when you zoom out from that, the transferable skills and the value that all of these different jobs or titles or occupations or buckets rather can kind of add to the world, it's a very cool thing. And you're just constantly trying to level up without getting too distracted by the noise, because LA is very noisy, man. And
yeah.
I didn't get to chat with you too much about it previously, but I want to touch on presence. You've said something before that was around the lines of presence kind of allows the past to go away and the future to disappear. Did I say that right? Is it something like that?
Sounds good to me. I don't know if I said it, but it sounds good.
What does presence mean to you?
Well, I think I try to find presence every day when I meditate. I don't always do the best job, but I do the job every day, or try to undo the job is probably a better way to say it. I try to not do anything, which
right,
is
it's
hard
not always
do.
What we hold on to. It's what we learn to let go of.
Yeah. Yeah. It's you know, doing nothing is a really hard thing to do, but, when I sit there and I forget about the things that I want to create in the future, and I let go of any regret from the past or anxiety that really isn't in the moment, you know, it's like either projected from the past or some sort of like thing, expectation, you know, that's somewhere out there in the future. And I just like stay where I am, and I just breathe, and I close my eyes, and I let go of any thoughts that I have, or I let go of any emotions that I have. And I kind of like sink more into my body. I realize that I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I'm right who I'm supposed to be. And I think that that gives me a sense of peace. And
I think that's very well said, man. Yeah. I think that the concept of presence, you do a very good job of it, especially when you're on stage. I learned this first by watching Jordan Peterson. I very much appreciate that you're comfortable in the pause. Even when I asked you this question about presence, there was a pause. And you're very comfortable to not allow the volume to turn up too high in your head as you're kind of processing and allowing yourself to think, or even sometimes pausing because it's going to allow the next thing to be like really resonating or a banger for the audience to receive. And that tells me that you have a good internal dialogue and ability to self-regulate your physiology and your emotions. And that's not an easy task, man. I don't normally see people from LA with that task.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I have this one poem called Silence, and I haven't done it in a while, but I get on stage and I'd be like, all right, this is called Silence. It took me my whole entire life to write this. It's probably my favorite poem. I rarely do it, but I'm going to do it for you right now. And I fucking do that shit for like minutes.
That's awesome.
What's happened, the audience would go through like these weird like reactions. Like at first, they would just sit there and maybe they start to laugh, you know? And then it gets quiet again. And then somebody starts to laugh. And then people start getting uncomfortable. And then sometimes people start crying. Which is super deep, just to fucking be with a group of people and just be quiet. You know, it really is very hard to not do anything. Mm-hmm. It's hard to not do anything.
I will say, though, like so much of communication is nonverbal.
Yeah.
And like observing. Like you're so good at like dramatically expressing unique emotions without words. And so in my observation, watching you there, I actually just experienced this in a somatic therapy session and then simultaneously was talking about it with a buddy. You exemplify like like screaming at the top of your lungs. When was the last time for our listeners, when was the last time any of you did that? Let it all out at the top of your lungs and just went for it, whether it was a roar, whether it was a cry, but just boom, let all that air that's trapped inside of you, just let it out. Mm. And then you showed some crying, you showed some laughter, you showed some like some smirking. And then like the way you navigated your headspace and your body language, I'm taking all those in and like partially it's humor, because some people will be listening to this on Apple or Spotify, not see it. So I'm like, oh, that's going to be great. They're like, what's going on? But then also simultaneously, it just shows like you really understand the art of communication.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the first person in my audience, you know. There's some things that I write, I just always give myself the freedom to never share everything. You know, some things I write, I never ever show him. Like, they're just for me. And when I do that, I know that when I'm finished with them, they're true, you know. And when they're true, then I decide, okay, is this the type of thing that I want to share with other people? Do I want to share it in a year? Do I never want anyone to hear it? But I think, I'm always communicating to myself first and trying to remind myself of these lessons, you know, philosophical observations, ways that I want to live, because I'm trying to become a better version of myself through my own poetry.
Mm-hmm. I really love that line. I am my first audience. That's good stuff, and hopefully grants people the permission to be more vulnerable, knowing that what they put down on paper, or even if they make a video on their phone, they have the power to choose if they actually want to share that. But it's still an outlet to get those things out of their headspace and out of their body and into the world, and then they can choose what they do with it after that.
100%. Yeah.
I want to read something real quick. You mentioned the breath, and this is something that you wrote that I very much appreciated. Humans take between 12,000 and 25,000 breaths a day, but we hardly notice any breaths we take. We just get swept away. We're stressed out by everything we have to do and say. We rarely ever stop and make the time to simply be, to take a breath and remind ourselves that we are free. And this conversation that we're having, the breath, it's a great way to regulate the physiology. It allows us to unlock trapped air, as I said before. But that word free, man, freedom to express, freedom to connect, freedom to feel, freedom to love, freedom to live life on our own terms. And that famous question, which Oprah's talked about that a lot, it's what do you want your life to look like? Let's create a roadmap to get there. It sounds so easy, but so many of us don't know what we actually want. When you put pen to paper here, what were the thoughts traveling through your headspace around the breath?
Well, you know, I used to smoke for many years, like, I don't know, many years back, you know, late teenager into my 20s, right? And I like quit when I was maybe 27 or something like that. And now looking back on it, I'm not sure if I was addicted to the nicotine or if the nicotine was actually just an excuse for me to take a deep breath. You know, because that's really what you're doing. You're just going... And it's like you're taking the nicotine in, but you're also taking in oxygen and you're forcing yourself to take a deep breath. And we don't really breathe. I mean, people actually, when you take a deep breath, people are like, what's wrong with you? You know, people say, are you okay? Literally, you know? So the reason why that poem was born was because I realized that. And then I was alone once. And I was so deeply thinking about something that I forgot to breathe. I literally was so focused on this problem that I had in my mind that I went, like, I had that, I need air. Not I'm normal breathing or I want air, but I need air. And I thought, sometimes I think so much that I forget to breathe. And then suddenly I remember air is something that I need. I gasped it in so desperately, my lungs began to, I don't remember the poem, but then I started like studying breath and I realized that that's what it is. Humans take between 12,000 and 25,000 breaths a day, yet we hardly notice any breaths we take. We just get swept away, we're stressed out by everything we have to do and say. I rarely ever stop and take the time to simply be, to take a breath and remind myself that I am free. to take a breath and remind ourselves that we are free. We are free.
So beautiful, man. Yeah. How do you gain access to all of these at the drop of a pen? They seem to not diffuse from your headspace, even though you're continually recreating. I mean, you mentioned you're putting together an album and a journal, and you recently wrote a book about a couple of years ago titled Inquire Within. How are you able to hold on to all of these different metaphors and analogies and not allow them to be lost into the abyss?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I would actually ping pong that back to you, because, like, for example, I don't know who mostly listens to your podcast, but I would assume that there are a lot of athletes, and maybe I'm projecting that, but that's my assumption. But I'll just speak to you. You are an athlete and you run this CrossFit gym, and we met through the Noble event with Todd and all the other incredible athletes that were there. And being around you guys made me realize, you know, I go to boxing and I do my little shit here and there, but I'm not like an athlete like that. I don't have the understanding or awareness of my body the way that you do. If I was to go into a CrossFit gym and you were coaching me, you would be telling me all of these things, and I might be able to get one or two at a time, and I would learn, and it would be good for me to get outside of my comfort zone. So I'll come visit you in San Diego and we'll make that happen. But like,
please do.
I'm not going to be able to remember the matrix of all of it the way you do, because you've just put in so much time around understanding your body and the different muscles and how they work. And you can probably have, you know, 30 things in your head at the same time while you're working out, or maybe I could have those two. And it's kind of the same thing for me. I've been doing this so long that it's second nature. And like, you know, once I memorize something or I visualize something, I actualize that thing, and it becomes kind of like a part of who I am. And maybe I have to brush up on it once or twice, but other than that, it's cellular for me, the way that, you know, CrossFit is cellular for you. So I think whatever we put our time into, you know, we learn things that we can't even express to other people. It's just on an experiential, energetic level. And I definitely know how to do poetry, you know?
Yeah, man. You definitely do. A lyricist and just somebody that has access to a vocabulary that rhymes and rhythms and resonates. And I think a lot of that, I've heard you say it before, it partially has to do with environment. Like, you do a good job of reiterating these things, whether it's in the shower, your drive to work, a walk in the park, sharing it with anybody and everybody that will listen. And inevitably, the shift in environment energy allows it to become, as you described, on the cellular level. And then what started as conscious competence, where you're like really thinking through it and trying to memorize and write and replicate, becomes unconscious competence, where it's almost like drinking a sip of water or brushing your teeth. And it's really, it's not something you see often in the world. You know, some of these things, no disrespect to CrossFit, but it's like there's so many CrossFitters that figure out the routine. And like, you can walk into a CrossFit gym and everybody's doing pull-ups and toe to bar and power cleans. It's very cool. But you don't walk around the world and see everybody doing what you do. And that's what really piques my eyebrows and really makes it stand out. And I was very fortunate at the Noble Film Festival roughly a year ago to see you give an incredible performance, and it started like this. I don't know who discovered water, but it probably wasn't a fish.
Yeah.
That right there.
I love that saying.
Like, stood out to me to a point that was like, it sounds so obvious, but you don't really hear people talk about it. When I say that, what was the first thing that came to mind?
Well, that's not my quote. And I actually don't know whose quote it is. I've looked it up and it said different things, like different people. So I actually, it's either one of a few people or completely unknown. But I love the quote. I don't know who discovered water, but probably wasn't a fish. And for me, it means you can't see your own environment when you're inside of it. And it's only when you get outside of it that you even know that it exists. And that's the thing about growing up, is like, you think whatever environment you grow up in is normal. And you think however you experience love is normal. And even if it's unhealthy, unhealthy is healthy to you.
Yeah, because you don't know what you don't know at that time.
Exactly. And there's so many different ways to live. And so I think that's part of being an adult, is learning who you are so you can unlearn who you are and decide who you want to be. And that's
the magic in unlearning is almost more important than the concept of learning. And I really like the way you said it. What gets you here isn't always what gets you there. That's something I'll definitely take away from our conversation. I think another way to summarize it, earlier this year, I was going through a really challenging breakup, all kinds of challenging things. And I remember saying to my buddy and a client of mine, I was like, man, dude, it feels like me against the world. And he paused and he put his finger on my chest and he goes, no, man, it's you against a world. There's a whole world out there for you to tinker and explore and love and nurture. And he's like, when the fog, fades a little bit, think about that. And I thought that really resonated with the concept of just the environment that you're in relation to the fish. And I mean, I can't help but think of Finding Nemo. I mean, because he inevitably changed his environment and learned a hell of a lot about the world before he was ready to.
Totally. I love that movie. I mean, I love all of those movies, so good, actually. Man.
They're so good.
So
poignant. And they have little things like just keep swimming, that are so good, man.
Well, it's kind of like what you were saying earlier. Some of the most profound things really come in the simplicity, which is full circle to what your father said, just keep dating. You know, it's like, that was so simple, but it was so profound. You say something to somebody and it can be a seed that you plant in their mind and in their heart, and it can grow at any time in the future. And you might not even see what it grows into, but that doesn't mean that it's not growing.
Move fast and break shit. LSKD develops functional sportswear with a streetwear aesthetic that's on a mission to inspire you to chase the vibe through sport, fitness, and adventure. I train daily in the rep shorts and love the versatility they offer. The zipper pocket is an absolute game changer. I go from training at the gym directly to meetings, running errands, or prepping for podcasts. The LSKD tribe has become true family, and we are excited to continue to develop our community. Shop now at lskd.com and use code ALLSMITH. We chase the vibe here at ALLSMITH. Let's all become 1% better every day. And on that concept of growing, man, there's another thing that you've talked about with regards to be careful what you grow. We are like a seed. We become what we contain. Every single thing we see started planted in our brains. And our thoughts are like the rain, and our moods are like the sun's rays, feeding our fate until our roots begin to take, and our sprouts begin to shape, and the tree of life escapes, branching out in love or hate, to destroy or create. It's fucking beautiful, man.
Thanks, brother.
Like, it's just so cool how you find the words. Like, I can say cliche things that sound great on a podcast, like be careful what you grow, and those are great lessons that people can take with them, but you just find this layer deeper that just like vibrates, man. And it's so cool the way you say it. When I'm able to kind of access some of these things, my rhythm's a little off, my cadence is a little different than yours, but hearing it from another voice, knowing that they're your words, does it echo a little different, or does it bring back certain memories as to when you wrote them?
I just like poetry. I really do. And I like it when it's somebody reading mine. I like it when I'm reading mine. I like it when somebody is reading theirs. I like it when I can create a space for people to tell their own story through spoken word in a way that they probably never normally would. And it's incredible for them to be empowered by that, or to be curious about changing a perspective, or, you know, deepening understanding about a certain part of their life. So just the fact that you are reading my poetry, or listening to my poetry, or speaking my poetry, it's an honor, man. I like look at it from the standpoint of, I feel very lucky that anybody listens to me at all. I had so many years where I had no idea if I was going to be successful at all, how I was going to survive in the world, let alone create abundance. And I never take that for granted. Anybody that's listening to me, I'm like really, truly grateful. And I always hope that they take whatever it is that they need to take for themselves to become happier and healthier in the world.
It's so special, man. It's something that that I'm hearing here is really that, like, success is not really a destination. It's not like a place that you go. In my opinion, something I'm in the midst of learning is that success is actually something you attract. And something I'm thinking about in relation to your story that I think every artist, entrepreneur, anybody in pursuit of trying to do something really special and unique goes through, it's a death of the old self and a celebration of the new self. And the imagery that comes to mind is you're a caterpillar, and this is you performing at the Poetry Lounge. And it's just not happening for you. You're in your 20s, and people are kind of like, dude, this guy's been here for 8 years, never really took off. He's not making any money. He's kind of a lost cause. Maybe he's washed up. Like, I don't know why he keeps coming back. And then you have this just internal belief that, hey, motherfucker, this little caterpillar is going to turn into a butterfly one day. You just wait and see. And you stick with it, and you stick with it. And then inevitably there comes a moment in time where maybe it's a level of pain, maybe it's a loss of a loved one, some sort of life disruption takes place, and you're in that cocoon, and that disruption just blows up the cocoon, and before you know it, you've got this wing, and you're like, whoa, I didn't have these things before. And then you spend, you know, a good amount of time like, how do I use this new tool? How do I figure out how to flap these things? And then over the course of time, you're like, whoa, I'm different. I'm evolved. I can see things from different lenses now. I'm not just on the ground crawling in a very slow pace. I move faster, but I can also move slow. I can connect with people. I can show off the beautiful colors that I possess. But everybody loves the butterfly, and nobody can really look back and celebrate the struggle of the caterpillar, the death that the caterpillar experienced, not realizing that it was going to become a butterfly, but literally thinking it was going to die. And that's what I'm hearing when I think about your story and why I think it's so fucking special that you don't like the bio. And you don't like the bio for a specific reason. And I'm hoping that that analogy and story maybe resonates with you in a non-poetic way.
I think it was very poetic. I think that was a poem right there. That was awesome, maybe, man. I thought the way you put that
together
was awesome. You should write that down. You should transcribe that. If you want to edit it, cool. If you don't, it's yours.
No, I definitely want to. It's something I've thought about often, but I don't know if I've actually verbalized it or articulated it.
That was great.
That was fun, man. That was cool.
Yeah, that was really, really right on and poignant. And to your great point, it's like the caterpillar becomes the butterfly, and then eventually the butterfly becomes the caterpillar again. But if the caterpillar becomes the butterfly and the butterfly survives and thrives, then the butterfly also knows that it was the caterpillar. And so when it becomes the caterpillar again, it's not as afraid of the cocoon because he knows it's going to be a bigger butterfly.
Yep.
You know,
that's such a great way of putting it, man. One last thing that I want to touch up with you that I think is very poignant. It comes a little bit from Buddhist philosophy, which is holding on to anger is like holding on to a hot piece of coal. You're the only one that gets burned. And he wrote something very beautiful around the concept of hate. And so many of us have this concept of hateful versus grateful. It's easy and cliche to talk about being grateful, but actually practicing that is really hard. I actually put a gratitude jar on my living room table. And so when people come over, I toss them a sticky note and a pen, and I just have them write down something they're grateful for, fold it up, put it in the jar. And as it fills up, I stuff it down even more. And then at the end of every year, we'll dump it out, and then all of us will kind of sit around That's the awesome. Table and read them out loud.
I love that.
And so this poem really is a cool one to me. The funny thing about hate is the person you hate doesn't feel that hate. You feel the hate. What comes to mind when you hear those words out loud, other than just kind of the sharing of knowledge?
Yeah, I wrote that about my dad. I mean, I wrote that about the hate that I had for him as a teenager. And the reality is that it didn't do anything but impact my life. Didn't impact his. And I think that's something anybody could use as a microcosm for any relationship, you know, or even anything you disagree with, you know, belief systems and, you know, politics. And it's like anybody or any group that you're hating, you know, it's you're just poisoning yourself. So forgiveness is for you first before it is for somebody else. And when you give that gift to yourself, you give that gift to someone else, and you can actually move on. And sometimes it happens in layers. It doesn't happen all at once, and it might not happen forever, but you have to keep forgiving over and over again. Because every time you do, you get a little bit lighter, and then the butterfly can fly higher.
Well, I definitely really needed to hear that. Does a part of you ever think in relation to your relationship with your father, like, look at me now?
No, I don't. My father passed away, and it's interesting. I'm not going to go into specifics, but I respected what he did in the world.
Okay.
Which is strange when you respect what someone has done with their life, but you don't respect who they were to you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a weird dichotomy to have. But we didn't really have a relationship when he passed. And I didn't expect that to ever change. And we had never really had a consistent relationship. I mean, I could hold on one hand maybe how many times we were in the same room together in my life. So I don't think, like, you know, if he could look at me now or he would be proud of me or any of those things. I kind of just think, like, thank you, because he was one of my biggest spiritual teachers in his absence and in his presence. I wouldn't be who I am without that. And so I don't even think of what he would think of me. I think of what I think mm-hmm. of me.
Yeah, I honor that. And I really appreciate you taking the time to share that, man. It's cool that you're in pursuit of your own validation. And that's what I think allows for the supreme level of curiosity, creation. I've heard you talk about just the relationship of valuable versus being validated. And you're definitely living a life that is very valuable. And you've created this commonality with the use of poetry and storytelling. As we kind of conclude today, man, what's the best advice that you've ever received?
Follow the path, and the path will lead the way. That's good advice. I don't know if it's the best advice, but I like that advice because, you know, when people can't figure out what their purpose is because it's too big, they should just go down the list of something that they're passionate about And if they can't figure out what they're passionate about, they should go down the list to what they're enthusiastic about or curious about or even slightly interested in, until you get to these really, really small steps. And you can learn to listen to that voice inside of you that is saying, make a right, make a left, go forward, be still, pursue this, say yes to this, say no to that. And you just keep stacking those things together, and that becomes your life. So follow the path.
It's like trusting that internal compass.
That's right. Yeah.
That's beautiful, man. What's the biggest lesson that you've learned in the last 12 months?
Wow. What is the biggest lesson I've learned in the past 12 months? I don't know. I mean, I guess many things kind of come to mind, but I had an incredible year. I had probably the best year of my life, you know, in my career or financially and in terms of impact and experiences, connections to myself and to other people. But even then, not everything, you know, matched up with my expectations and the reality, right? And there were a lot of kind of like personal challenges along the way. But one thing is, when I look back on my life, all of the challenges in the rear view were necessary, as we've discussed, to make me who I am. And so denying those things would be denying a part of myself. And what I want to be able to do is bring that into real time, so that the challenges that I'm going through now, I don't get so wrapped up in the minutia of, that I actually just forget that eventually they'll be in the rearview mirror. And
yeah, very well said.
They'll be a part of who I am. And so I think just to trust, just to throw my hands up and enjoy the ride rather than hold on so tightly to the steering wheel or to the roller coaster railing, you know, mm-hmm. and just enjoy every moment, man. We're the world is in a lot of turmoil right now. People are going through a lot of real challenges, but we're also so lucky to be alive, and I wouldn't want to be alive at any other time. And being alive at all is a fucking miracle. And mm-hmm. I want to be present for it as long as I can.
That's beautiful, man. What's the worst advice that you've ever received?
The worst advice I've ever received. You know, sometimes I look at these Twitter things. I'm on X a lot. There'll be these like toxic masculine like advice threads, and I like mm-hmm. will peek at them because they're like funny to me. And then also sometimes I'll see some that are very inspiring, like they give really good principles for masculinity, but also just for leadership or just living a good disciplined life. But one of the things I read the other day was some fucking schmuck was like, being nice never does anything for you. You know, it was like one of those things. It was basically saying that like, in order to get ahead, you have to be cutthroat and you have to like put your own needs in front of everybody else. And this kind of like Machiavellian view of the world. And I think that's bad advice.
Yeah.
You know, I think, look, there are moments where that is necessary, and I would never pretend that it's not. But I think, like, if you walk around the world, and I'm still even saying this to myself, and you think that the world is going to collapse in on you at any moment, it's like you're always bracing for somebody to hit you in the face, basically. And maybe when they do hit you in the face, it doesn't hurt as much because you're not blindsided by it, so you don't fall down. But what you don't realize is the amount of time that you spend bracing is its own pain. Yep. You know, like tense, everything's tense, everything's about to happen. You know, it's me against the world. I mean, that's its own pain. And like, I think just being willing to open up, trust the world, but also trust yourself that you'll be able to handle things as they come, and preparing to just be the best version of yourself in all ways. That's the opposite side of that. And being nice and being compassionate is what the world needs more of right now, you know?
Yeah, totally, man. I think it's kindness within context. I think it's being a kind human being, drawing boundaries when needed. Mm-hmm. And within those boundaries, you know, you do have to fill your own cup before you can fill the cup of others, but you don't have to do it in a negative fashion. I think that just comes with the appropriate discipline to time block and do things within the rhyme and rhythm and the parameters within your lifestyle so that you can be a service-oriented, loving human being that is in pursuit of sharing those key concepts with the world. Like you said, if you're just bracing all the time, your lenses are also probably fogged with anticipating problems,
right,
and not seeing the good. And I think it's important to be able to do both and be in pursuit of seeing the good things. And we've all heard the famous analogy of the yellow Lamborghini. If you see one, you're thinking about it, you're probably going to start seeing a few more. But that holds true with negativity in the world too. Negativity can be really loud. It gets a lot more clicks and it creates a lot more controversy, especially in the worlds of Instagram, Twitter, X, and YouTube. But simultaneously, man, kindness is dope. I think kindness is just a cool thing. I've got some really kind friends. A few of them love wearing the hats that say hug dealer. I think that's one of my favorite ones. People in the world need more hugs, man. I learned the other day that people need on average about 8 hugs to feel totally fulfilled. And maybe that's a key takeaway from that concept of the worst advice that you've ever received. My last question for you today, NQ, if you could have one law in the world that everybody had to follow, what would that law be?
God, these last questions are rough.
I know. I'm trying to challenge you to think a little bit deeper. And honestly, my hope is that they inspire you and your next piece that you choose to write and get people kind of playing and tinkering with some of these thought patterns.
Yeah, well, I will say, you know, I do a lot of podcasts, man. I've done so many. I really probably can't count. And I've really enjoyed this conversation, man. You're an excellent host and an excellent conversationalist. And yeah, thank you very much for having me. Like, I've really liked the way that we've batted ideas back and forth and hope that other people enjoyed this as much as I did. I don't know that I have a specific law that I would want to apply.
You want to tag me in since we collaborated earlier? I think I can help you out. Sure, I'll share one with you that I heard. I heard an awesome one from Will Smith.
Okay.
And he said if he had a law, it would be that he would wish that the recipient of a question would then repeat that question back to the asker to ensure that they better understood the question. So it got rid of the potential misunderstanding of the question. Yeah, or in other words, repeating back something that you heard, like in the form of mirroring, maybe something that a therapist might use in some cases, just to ensure that what is said and what is heard are in alignment to diffuse any sort of misunderstanding. And the reason why I chose that one to share with you is just because you're a master at communication, man.
So just to be clear, it's making sure that whatever question was asked is repeated back so that there's no misalignment and you're asking me.
And it doesn't have to be a question. It could also just be like, hey, what I'm hearing you say is,
right,
and then repeat it back to the person just to ensure the clear and concise communication.
I know. I was trying to make a joke. I was just trying to repeat it.
Well played. And I did it back on accident.
Well, that's just a never-ending loop, right? We'll be here forever.
I know, totally.
People are like, totally, when is this podcast over?
Totally. Hey, what are you working on right now? Where can people find you to kind of gain access to the incredible artistry that you're putting out into the world?
Thanks, man. Well, they can obviously get the book that you mentioned earlier, Inquire Within. I can show it to people. I always have it when I do these podcasts. So it's right here. And
hey, is it on audiobook? Can I listen to you?
Yeah, it's on audiobook as well.
Oh, that's awesome.
So people actually sometimes will get both, and then they'll listen to them while they're reading them, which is pretty cool.
That's cool.
And then, you know, they can go to my website, in-q.com, and that has all sorts of stuff, including my Amazon special that's out there, NQ Live at the Ace Theater. Lots of videos. I have a Disney movie that I wrote songs on that's coming out in this next year. Lots more public shows, lots more public workshops, lots more private corporate shows. If anybody out there is interested in something like that, you can always reach out. And then to get ready for this album and this journal that we're going to put out in May for Mental Health Month. I haven't really teased a lot of that yet, at least on my socials or on my newsletter, but I'm happy to discuss it in conversations. And I'm really, really excited about it because it's going to provide the framework for other people to do what they do in my workshops live, but alone. So it's a guided poetry course for self-reflection and self-expression.
That's incredible, man. Constantly putting tools for people to pursue their peak expression.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed our conversation today, man. I'm so thankful for you carving out some time to connect with me. And you're a special man. Thank you.
Thank you, Bryce. Back at you, man.
For those of you listening or observing on YouTube, if you enjoyed my conversation with NQ today, please rate, review, subscribe, and thank you for tuning in to another episode of The All Smith Project. And remember, greatness is forged, not found.